Good afternoon, Regent Radio listeners. This is Ome Sama Rahimtula, and I am joined on the line with Dr. Gerald Horn. Hello, Dr. Horn.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, and you today?
I'm okay. Now, tell me, this will be broadcast on Saturday, December 8th, is that correct?
Yes, and we are today, Friday, December 7th.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, of course, December 7th marks Pearl Harbor Day.
Yes.
That's what it's called in the United States, although I should also note that on December 7th, 1941, perhaps December 8th, Hong Kong time, you had a real catastrophe for the Canadian military as Japanese troops overran Tokyo. And I dare say that the kind of catastrophe that Canadians suffered fighting basically under the Union Jack, under Britain's administration, was one of many factors that helps to generate a certain kind of Canadian nationalism. Although, in light of what we talked about last week in terms of a Canadian Mark Carney becoming head of the Bank of England, which is one of the most powerful posts in London, perhaps we historians have overestimated Canadian nationalism, since you have Canadians still crossing the Atlantic taking powerful posts under the Union Jack.
And since it is the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, is there anything else that you wanted to say more generally on that?
Well, you know, Ome, that I wrote this book some years ago called Race War, which dealt with how Tokyo, how pre-1941 Japan tried to attain its place in the sun, basically by playing rather adroitly upon the bruised feelings created by white supremacy. In other words, Tokyo basically said to people of color, particularly people of African descent, but also people of Indian descent as well, that if you align with Tokyo against the North Atlantic powers, well, then you will no longer face the kind of persecution that you face under the Stars and Stripes, under the Union Jack, etc. You may recall that this struck a particular chord in India, then under British rule. India doesn't become independent until August 15, 1947. One of the stalwarts of the Indian independence struggle. He's viewed that way today in New Delhi, as Subhas Chandra Bose, who basically was pro-Tokyo all the way. And the same can be said, quite frankly, of a lot of the black nationalists in the Americas, particularly in the United States of America. And as I argued in this book, this ability of Tokyo to turn white supremacy back against itself in a jujitsu-like maneuver was one of the many factors that led to the crumbling of white supremacy following the atomic bombing of Japan in August 1945. And I should also say, of course, that the fact that Japan is the only nation that's been subjected to atomic weaponry stems directly from its attempt to play upon the bruised feelings created by white supremacy. So Pearl Harbor Day, 1941, December 7th, is a day that U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt said that would live forever in infamy, perhaps, but I would also say that it is an important day in terms of the fortunate disintegration of the most egregious aspects of white supremacy.
And modern-day Japan, there's elections coming up on December 16th, I believe?
Very shortly, and it's an important election. The so-called Liberal Democratic Party, which it has been said that it's neither liberal nor democratic nor hardly a party, the organization that has ruled Japan for most of the post-1945 era before being ousted by the so-called Democratic Party of Japan, is supposed to be making a comeback under Shinzo Abe, who you may recall served as Prime Minister of Japan a few years ago. I mean, there's this a round robin of Japanese men who serve as prime minister. They seem to have one every few months, so it's understandable if the audience or even if commentators and pundits can't keep up with them. But I think for our purposes, the significance of this election may be that if Shinzo Abe is elected, which is expected, he is a right-winger, and this does not augur well for the rather frazzled relations between Japan and China that have been worsened by a territorial dispute. As we've said on this program a number of times in recent weeks, one of the most worrisome aspects of what's going on in the world right now are the territorial disputes between Japan and its neighbors, between China and its neighbors, between China and Japan, between China and the Philippines, between China and Vietnam, between China and India. It's very worrisome because basically, I would say that what China is doing is basically helping to create an alliance against Beijing that then Washington could then play upon. It's very disturbing, and if Shinzo Abe is elected, it seems to me that we'd be one step further to an international crisis since he's a right-wing hawk. At the same time, there are those who say that if Shinzo Abe is elected, being a right-wing hawk, that he will be in a position, much better position than a left-winger, to negotiate with China because, of course, the right wing will give him more slack. I don't know. I find it very disturbing that he may be coming back to power.
And Japanese elections are not the only ones going on. The polls have just closed in Ghana, and it's a tight race, or so the polls are predicting, between the current president, John Mahama, and Nana Akufo-Addo. And, of course, President Mahama took over the presidency after the death of John Atta Mills in July.
Well, a couple things about that. One, John Mahama, the incumbent, has written a very affecting memoir. You can find it under his name, Mahama. And it's very well written, and it's very evocative of growing up in Ghana as a child some decades ago, and I recommend it highly. It's generally expected that he will prevail. We'll see. But Ghana is a flagship country in the Pan-African world. We all know that its coming to independence in 1957 was a landmark in terms of decolonization in Africa below the Sahara following Sudan in 1956. We all know about Kwame Nkrumah, the first leader of independent Ghana, who you may recall, studied in the United States and was very close to the U.S. progressive movement, including W.E.B. Du Bois and his spouse, Shirley Graham Du Bois, who we invited to Ghana in 1961, and of course, they did repatriate there. And today, Ghana is something of an island of stability in West Africa. We're well aware of the kind of turmoil that has beset Cote d'Ivoire, its neighbor, a former French colony, where the French basically dropped paratroopers into Abidjan some months ago to install a new leader of that country. And we all know about the turmoil that routinely afflicts Nigeria, the giant of the continent, particularly now with the so-called Boko Haram, a so-called Islamist organization, blowing up churches and attacking worshipers, attacking government facilities and all the rest. Whereas Ghana basically goes through peaceful transitions, at least it has done in recent years, although we recall that in the 1970s, and particularly when Kwame Nkrumah was overthrown three or four decades ago, that it has been the victim of military coups itself, but certainly not in recent years. And Ghana has also benefited from economic development. Offshore oil has been found there. What's quite striking is that Ghana is now climbing the ladder of industrialization. You may recall that this usually starts with manufacturing clothes. That was the pattern in the United States. Actually, that was the pattern in Britain with the Industrial Revolution, then the United States, and then Asia. And now you see Ghana now becoming a leading manufacturing of garments. And that's usually a step on the ladder to further economic development. So we'll all be watching the results of these elections in Ghana with bated breath.
And we'll definitely follow up on that for next week. You did mention the instability in West Africa. Of course, Mali would be one of those countries. Can you give us an update on that?
It's sort of depressing, I'm afraid, to talk about it. Listeners to Region Radio know more than most that the problems in Mali started in 2011 with the NATO bombing campaign in neighboring Libya. It turns out now, just reported in the New York Times, that the so-called rebels that the United States and Canada, I'm afraid, also supported were in close touch with the so-called Islamists who have now taken over northern Mali, an area larger than France, and have been persecuting women in particular. Particularly, they seem to have a particular beef against single women with children, which is quite striking because that makes it sound like North America. In any case, what's happening is that the West African nations and the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, is consulting with the United Nations Security Council about a military intervention in northern Mali. The problem is they've been talking about this for quite a long time, and it makes one think that there is a sort of certain reluctance or hesitancy to intervene, which I fully understand because I don't think that intervention would be a good idea, and I dare say that there are forces within the foreign ministries in Nigeria which would be expected to play the leading role of this intervention that would agree that it's going to be more than a notion to dispatch these so-called Islamists who are ruling, who are quite battle-hardened and battle-toughened, who are armed to the teeth thanks to the United States and its allies, although I should say that they're also well-armed thanks to Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Qatar, of course, the small Gulf Arab nation that founded Al Jazeera, and has really been throwing its weight around, not only in Africa, but in Syria in particular, and has become a major player. And so because these forces in northern Mali are well-armed and are very good fighters, there is an understandable reluctance to authorize a military intervention. Then, of course, you have Russia and China on the United Nations Security Council, who opposed, in many ways, the intervention in Libya in the first place that's created this mess. And now Russia and China are being pressed to authorize an intervention in Syria, and they're beginning to scratch their heads and wonder, do these North Atlantic nations really know what they're doing? And since I know these North Atlantic nations very well, I would tell them, no, they don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they're doing in the sense that they do not necessarily understand that they're helping to create a whirlwind that will come back to haunt them, just like the whirlwind they created in Afghanistan has come back to haunt them, or came back to haunt them on September 11th, 2001. So whether or not this military intervention takes place in Mali is still up in the air. Although, if you were to press me, I would say that it'll probably go forward. But I don't think it's going to end very well. I think it'll end in tears. And I think it'll probably wind up creating more problems than it was designed to solve.
And is there any updates in Libya? Obviously, there's a whole bunch of stuff still going on in the aftermath. Is there anything that you'd like to report on?
Well, just that dark-skinned people continue to be persecuted. That's one of the major legacies of Libya. It's well known that it was the perception amongst the rebels that dark-skinned people, such as myself and yourself, were supportive of the previous regime under Colonel Gaddafi. And therefore, you have towns of the dark-skinned that have basically been turned into ghost towns in Libya. You have workers, expatriate workers from Ghana and Nigeria and elsewhere, who've basically been chased back home. And perhaps allied to that is the fact that in Benghazi, which was the cradle and the crucible of the rebellion against Mr. Gaddafi, you basically have a disintegration of so-called law and order. One definition of a state is that it maintains a monopoly of violence. That is to say that it's okay for, say, the state of Texas to execute you, but it's not okay for me to execute someone in the state of Texas. The state has the monopoly of violence. Well, in Benghazi in particular, there's no monopoly of violence. I mean, you have these ragtag militias who have taken it upon themselves to execute violence in their own name. And so it's a Mad Max situation that's unfolding in Benghazi. I hesitate to use the term state of anarchy, because I know my friends in Canada will reprimand me for using anarchy in a negative sense, but I'm trying to convey this idea that there are no rules of the road, that basically you have a sort of de facto administration, neighborhood by neighborhood, of various militias. And this is what NATO intervention has wrought. And I would hope that our friends in Canada in particular would put questions to their parliamentarians, who then would put questions to the foreign ministry and Stephen Harper, as to what are they going to do to clean up the mess that they created in North Africa.
And, you know, as a sociologist, I'm very excited, that's an exaggeration, that you're bringing up Max Weber in our conversation. Moving over to Syria now, you had sent me this story, and I'm going to try to get this right, but the U.S. is trying to put pressure on Iraq to forbid Iran from entering its airspace because Iran is transporting arms to Syria to beef up the Syrian government in their, you know, persecution against the protests from the people. So can you tell us about this kind of new pressure, I guess, that the States is trying to put on Iraq, and then also an update on Syria?
Well, Washington feels that since it invested blood and treasure in overthrowing Saddam Hussein, that the United States has the right, if not the obligation, to order the internal, if not the external, affairs of the Baghdad regime. Needless to say, President al-Maliki of Iraq disagrees rather substantially with that idea. But in any case, Washington is pressuring his government to stop Iran from supplying the Damascus regime. We all know that, among other things, the war in Syria is a proxy war between Iran on the one hand and, on the other hand, Saudi Arabia and, once again, Qatar, supported by the United States and the North Atlantic countries. If you believe what you read in the North Atlantic press, Mr. al-Assad in Damascus, his days are numbered. That's what they keep telling us, although he's still hanging on. And those claims may be inflated because it is apparent that these rebels are having a difficulty holding territory. They can claim a neighborhood or claim a region, but it's difficult for them to hold it when the Syrian Damascus-based regime strikes back. Not only that, but there's a further problem, it seems to me, and that is that Turkey has basically requested that NATO get involved by supplying Turkey with so-called Patriot defensive missiles to stop attacks from neighboring Syria. We all know that Turkey doesn't enter this situation with clean hands because it's supporting the rebels, and it should not be surprised if the Damascus regime then strikes back or shoots back at such aggression. And Turkey in particular, it seems to me, is playing a very dangerous game. Turkey has escalated its trade relations with Iran and Iraq in particular, but at the same time is crossing swords with Iran and Iraq on the territory of Syria. Not only that, but there is a Kurdish question. The Kurds are a minority group that stretch into from Turkey into Iraq and also into Syria. And in Iraq, the Kurds have attained a de facto autonomy. And this is one of the major issues in Iraq because there's oil on Kurdish soil, and the United States has encouraged Kurdish autonomy, feeling that it can do an end run around the Baghdad regime and deal directly with the Kurds with regard to oil. The problem from the Turkish point of view is that when the Kurds in Iraq are empowered, they will seek to empower their brethren across the border in Turkey. And that is not good news for the Turkish regime, which has been fighting a very violent war against the Kurds for years now. So Turkish policy in its neighborhood, quite frankly, is rather contradictory in the sense that on the one hand, they're taking actions to build up Kurdish autonomy and build up Kurdish militancy. And on the other hand, they're seeking to squash Kurdish militancy on their own soil. Quite frankly, it's a real head-scratcher. It doesn't make that much sense in the long term. But we shall see what happens. Obviously, Syria has been turned into a battleground. The Israelis should be nervous about what should unfold or what will unfold in Syria, because the so-called Salafists, who are sponsored by Saudi Arabia, have been gaining ground in terms of leading the rebel ranks. And I don't think that they'll be very happy to have Israel as a neighbor if they come to power in Damascus. I don't think they'll be very happy about Israel occupying Syrian territory as it does for decades. I'm speaking of the Golan Heights. And so a real catastrophe you can see unfolding if Mr. al-Assad is dispatched. And speaking of catastrophes unfolding, I shouldn't go another second without mentioning what's going on in neighboring Egypt.
Yeah.
For the last few days, there have been these enormous demonstrations and protests. And to use a kind of shorthand, it's basically a battle between what are referred to as the secularists and what are referred to as the Islamicists. Now, you know, that's something of an overstatement, but for our purposes here in our abbreviated period of time, that's the best we can do. President Morsi, who is seen as an Islamicist, obviously he's a former leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, outraged many of his political opponents by seeming to want to impose a so-called state of emergency that he said would only last for a short period. But, you know, these states of emergency have a tendency to last for decades. That's been the tendency in that part of the world. And that's brought people out into the street, not only into Tahrir Square, but what Mr. Morsi should be concerned about is the hundreds of thousands who are amassing outside of the presidential palace, which has caused his elite presidential guard to erect barbed wire around the palace, which may be the only thing standing between protesters reaching his person. Speaking of Mr. Morsi himself, as we speak on December 7, 2012, it's unclear how this is going to unfold. He's still calling for a referendum on a constitution that will take place on December 15th, a week from Saturday, December 8th. This referendum on a constitution is controversial because many of the Coptic Christian minority, many of the feminists, many of the leading secularists had basically stormed out of the proceedings, feeling that it was a stacked deck. Lurking in the background is the Egyptian military, which actually might wind up being the ultimate victor, irrespective of who prevails in terms of this immediate struggle between what has been portrayed as the secularists versus the Islamicists.
And what is the position of the military in terms of these protests? We know during the revolution in Tahrir Square that they were very much, on the side of the protesters, and that, you know, seems to have maybe wavered one way or another in terms of the way things turned out. And I've been reading, you know, stories here and there that, again, the army, might be siding with, the people, quote unquote. And what is their position in terms of this kind of protest?
Well, the military situation has to be very careful, because this protest could lead to a split in their ranks. That is to say, many of the rank and file in the military are split between so-called Islamicists and so-called secularists. At the same time, the Constitution, which is up for referendum on December 15th, is seen as a victory for the military. It seems as if President Morsi felt that he and his Muslim Brotherhood had to make concessions to the military. But the military being seen as supportive of President Morsi when thousands and tens of thousands are storming the presidential palace, I'm not sure if that's the kind of message they would like to send out. I think it's a possibility, as you begin to read the tea leaves today, December 7th, that these protests could lead to a fragmenting of the military. But even that's not necessarily good news for progressive forces, because we know from history that when a military in such a situation as we find in Egypt today begins to fragment, it can lead to one side basically liquidating their political opponents. that is to say, taking to the sword and taking to bloodshed in order to solve what is fundamentally a political question.
And in the last 5 minutes that we have, and if it does take us longer to talk about this last issue, I hope you will oblige us with a few extra minutes. Last week, the UN passing a resolution that gave Palestine non-voting observer status within the General Assembly, I think. So the implications of that, of course, Israel and the United States getting worried that with Palestine having this kind of power within the UN structure might, for example, file a case in the ICC. So lots of kind of different implications for that. And also, surprisingly, I don't know what's going on, Stephen Harper came out and warned Israel not to build any more settlements in East Jerusalem, which I think came as a bit of a shock to Canadians.
Well, understandably, but on the other hand, consider that he was walking in the footsteps of Britain, France, Spain, and the Netherlands, who, after the recent declaration that these new settlements would be built in the vicinity of Jerusalem, which would basically make a resultant Palestinian state that not be contiguous, that is to say, it would be like pre-Bangladesh Pakistan, you recall? You recall Pakistan, where
yes.
West of India was one side of Pakistan,
East
which is
Pakistan.
Where we see Pakistan today, and east of India, on the other side of the subcontinent, was eastern Pakistan, which is now Bangladesh. I mean, it's almost a prescription for a division of a Palestinian state, what Mr. Netanyahu is doing, which I assume is the reason why he's doing it, not only in terms of building settlements and claiming more land, but also basically putting a stake through the heart of an independent Palestinian state, guaranteeing that you'll have two wings of Palestine basically squabbling with each other, just like you had with pre-Bangladesh Pakistan, which led to a split of that particular nation. But I would warn the Israelis to tread very carefully. You mentioned the possibility, the prospect of the leaders being dragged into the International Criminal Court for various transgressions. But I would also warn the apartheid state that is Israel about the fate and the history of its predecessor. I'm speaking of apartheid South Africa. Recall that apartheid South Africa had occupied neighboring Namibia, Southwest Africa, a sprawling territory larger than Texas and California combined, although it has a population of only about 2 million. Texas and California have a population of about maybe 60 million, that is to say almost twice the population of Canada. And so apartheid South Africa felt that it could bully Namibia successfully, and they were doing so until you had the intervention in Namibia's northern neighbor, which was Angola, in the 1970s by Cuban troops who came to assist the Angolan government to repel an apartheid invasion of Angola. In other words, the apartheid regime was basically a running rampant. It was rampaging throughout southern Africa until the advent of the Cuban troops. And the Cuban troops proceeded to expel the apartheid military from Angola, and then that created the conditions for the apartheid evacuation of Namibia. But keep in mind that lingering and lurking in the background in the latter stages of the apartheid occupation of Namibia was the idea that if the apartheid forces did not evacuate Namibia, they would be expelled forcibly by the Cuban troops. And then the idea was, well, if the Cuban troops expelled the apartheid army from Namibia, well, why stop there? Why not just march on to Pretoria and just expel these apartheid criminals altogether? And certainly that kind of possibility hanging in the air made the apartheid authorities more susceptible to sweet reason, shall we say. And I think, I dare say, that with the enhanced status of Palestine, the Palestinian government, if you like, could possibly call upon its allies to expel this illegal occupation of its territory. And once you have the introduction of foreign troops, I doubt if they'll be Cuban in this case, but you know, the Cuban military is rather frisky, that once those foreign troops are introduced into Palestine, well why should they just stop with expelling the illegal occupation from Palestine itself? And who is to say, given that Israel is based largely on contested territory, that why should they stop in Palestine in the first place? I'm just raising these possibilities. I'm not recommending these possibilities. I'm just raising this scenario to suggest that Israel, whether it knows it or not, is skating on very thin ice. And then there's the other issue that I raised a moment or two ago, this Islamist spring that's spreading throughout North Africa and the region. And I don't think that the Israelis are going to be very pleased with their new neighbors. As a matter of fact, I don't think the new neighbors will be pleased with the Israelis either, for that matter. And that's creating a very combustible situation that could also explode in the face of the Israelis. So it seems to me the Israelis would be well advised to negotiate while there's still time. But instead, they're playing a reckless and dangerous game and seemingly trying to escalate the scenario. You may have noted that Prime Minister Netanyahu was just in Berlin this week and talking to Angela Merkel, the chancellor, and Germany has taken a very soft line for reasons that should be evident with regard to Israel. But even the German line against Israel is stiffening in light of this latest announcement about building settlements in the neighborhood of Jerusalem. So the Israeli situation is much more dire than I think they realize. Their trump card is, at least they think their trump card is, that they will eternally have the support of Washington and Ottawa. Well, we all know that there were other regimes in recent history who always thought that they would have the support of Ottawa and Washington. I'm thinking of, you know, the Shah of Iran, the South Vietnamese government. The list is long. So once again, I would caution the Israelis to pay attention to what's going on, because they're basically walking on banana peels.
So we have come to the end of the time that we have for this week, but I'd like to thank you once again for joining us, and hopefully we'll talk to you again next week.
I hope so. Take care.
Okay. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.